I found myself in a high-speed chase in a stolen car, high and drunk, and a handgun sitting next to me. When I go back to the rehab center that I eventually got released into, they used to say all the time, you just have to have blind faith.
So how did you get rich? Like, what's your story?
Well, and this is why.
Dan Martell is a best-selling author of Buy Back Your Time, a top business growth coach, and the founder of Martell Ventures, which generates over $100 million in revenue.
From jail and rehab at 17 to building and selling multiple tech companies, he now helps entrepreneurs scale their businesses and reclaim their time.
I remember the first time my accountant called me. His name was Mark. He calls me up and he goes, you want to hear something cool? I said, what's that? He goes, you have $1 million in cash in your business.
What is the one question people were more interested in about you and your views of the world?
One thing that I believe that most people don't believe is that I...
What's up, guys? Welcome to this episode of Unemployable. This is a super special podcast. We have a friend of mine, Dan Martell, here in the studio all the way from Canada. Dan and I first crossed paths over a decade ago at a business event in New York. We spent a weekend growing and getting better as business people. Dan has since blown up, become really well known globally. We talk about his book. We talk about how he's now going from nine-figure, shooting for 10-figure net worth, how he's actually doing it, what he's prioritizing in his life, the growth challenges that he's had personally as he levels up and levels up and levels up, the challenges you experience in life and business as you grow at hyper speed. We get into time management, you know, dealing with people and how to find true joy and meaning and be running businesses, not separate to each other. So it's a really interesting discussion. I know you're going to love it. Make sure you drop a comment. You know what to do. Have a great day and we'll see you on the other side. What is up, everybody? Welcome to this episode of Unemployable. We have an extremely special guest in the house today, all the way from Canada, the one and only Dan Martell. How are you, Dan?
I'm here down under. I'm here not to fuck spiders. That's what I'm doing today.
Mate, I'll tell you what, I've been watching you on your stories, and for a guy having a holiday in Australia, you certainly do a lot of podcasts and a lot of work. You are a machine. How have you found it coming back after all these years?
I mean, 20 years ago, I came here as a backpacker, broke, and coming back now with more resources is kind of a lot funner.
Yeah.
You know, I just, it's so neat to kind of remember the headspace you were in a moment in time back in your life, and then kind of come back to that same place and just see how dramatically different you are.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's important of, like, you know, for me, journaling, I need to be able to create separation from my thoughts, because I think a lot of us think we are our thoughts and we're not. And just like coming back to this place has been beautiful. And, you know, just like keeping the schedule for me, I create a rhythm of existence, which is something that I do even on vacation. Like, one of my favorite things to show my friends is like, go on vacation, come back healthier. What a crazy idea.
Yeah.
So yeah, when I travel, I always, like, usually once every fourth day, I'll want to add some kind of like media stuff or some business meetings, and it just makes it feel like I'm still in momentum.
Yeah, I mean, you just haven't missed on your schedule at all the whole time you've been here. The stories have been, which is just a way of living, which I want to jump into. I've been following you for a long time, actually. I was just thinking about it leading up to this. I think I first discovered you through Andrew Warner and Mixergy. Were you?
Dude, that's very old school. Yeah, I was just chatting with Andrew the other day. I was trying to connect in Austin, but...
Is he still around doing that?
He's still, yeah, from my understanding, as we were talking about doing his pod. Yeah, he's probably been doing it for 13 years.
Yeah, yeah. Because that's where I think I first discovered you, and I became an early customer of Clarity, because I moved to the US. I started an explainer video animation company, and I needed advice on all kinds of stuff. So I used Clarity.
Oh, that's so cool.
And that's, so I've watched you from that time. And then, of course, we were at the same event in New York with Yannick Silva. And you were into your fitness then, but you seem to have taken it to a whole nother level. So I want to start by just saying the book's amazing. Like, honestly, I listened to the audio, and if you are an entrepreneur listening to this, this is a book you must get. It is what struck me about this book. There's a lot of business books, and I have a sort of policy now where I'll read or listen to half an hour or 20 minutes. And if I'm not captured, if it's not clear, if it's not organized, I'm just out, right?
Yep.
This book was so beautifully clear. And whoever you hired, you mentioned, I think it was a Bowen or a guy who helped you with your framework.
The model, Simon Bowen, he's actually from Perth. He was an Australian.
Incredible. Like the number of usable frameworks that are in that book, I feel like I got to go back and just listen to it a few times. It was just remarkable. So well done on the book. It's sincerely amazing.
Yeah, it was 3 years of my life and I put my heart and soul into it.
Yeah.
It was the thing I wanted to bring to the world. All my entrepreneurial friends kept asking me, well, how do you do all the stuff you do? And I, you know, try to draw them diagrams and workflow processes. And I realized I didn't have a complete system. And sitting down to actually, when I wrote the book, it was unique as I wrote down 25 people's names of, you know, folks in my life that I love, other entrepreneurs that I knew struggled with different aspects of letting go, because really that's what the book's about. And I just slowly address each one of their objections, their challenges, their beliefs, their blockages. And it's right now the number one book in entrepreneurship, productivity, and time management, which is crazy to me.
It's one of those books that you can just see. It's not just a book written to raise somebody's personal brand or credibility. No. It is a proper, and it really right at the very end when you went through the acknowledgements, it was revealed.
Dude, you actually read the whole thing.
I read everything.
Because that's so
cool. When I see that level of excellence, I really do deeply want to understand what goes into it. It's like when you walked in here, you said, I like that you guys have invested some
show effort. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was going, who helped Dan with this? Because this is just so extraordinary. So, and I think it ties also directly to why we're in business, which is to gain agency over our life. The book's called Buy Back Your Time. And it really gets into the strategies. Such a granular level. There's a couple that I'll dive into a bit later that I'd love to, but I don't want to spend all the time in the book because I think there's more to Dan Martell than just what's in the book, which is extraordinary. But I do want to just kick off with just giving a frame to people who don't know you, don't know your backstory. This is the first time they've ever seen you, and there'll be a lot of our audience that are in that category. So how did you get rich? Like, what's your story?
Well, and this is why I love the question. I don't mind revisiting it because I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of people out there doing success theater and you see them talk about, you got to do this, you got to do that, but they don't tell you where they started. And if I don't know who you are, I just don't trust you, period, full stop. Yeah. And my quick story is I grew up in a lot of challenges at home. My mom was an alcoholic, so I grew up in a home with abuse and alcoholism and addiction. And, you know, as a teenager, got in a lot of trouble, as I'm assuming a lot of people listening to this. If you're unemployable, it's usually because you have strong opinions about the way the world should be.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I didn't have a positive way to express those. But, you know, through a series of bad decisions, I found myself in a high-speed chase, in a stolen car, high and drunk, and a handgun sitting next to me.
Yeah.
And I got chased by the police and ended up crashing inside of a house, and I went for the handgun.
Mm.
And it's kind of crazy to think today, 27 years later, that in that moment, I might not have been here.
Was it your plan? I've heard the story a couple of times online and in the book, obviously it opens with that very detailed account and it takes you right to that moment. I remember I was doing my walk and I almost stopped and thought about how significant that moment would have been for a young guy, drunk and high, with a, you know, rearview mirror in a stolen car full of police and lights. Mm-hmm. And if you'd actually gotten to that gun, was it your intention to actually pull the gun and finish it right there and just hope they take your life?
I knew I wouldn't have had the guts to do it to myself.
Right.
So I figured if I just pointed at the gun, the cops would do it for me.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, I'd already been to jail twice by that point. I told myself when I stole the car that I just didn't want to go back.
Mm.
I mean, I had zero self-worth. I felt like I didn't deserve to breathe the air I was breathing. So to me, it just felt like a better solution to the problem I was in.
There was another part in the book that kind of links a little bit to this. I come from a really religious upbringing. I was born into a fundamental Christian family, went to church 3-4 times a week. Age 21, I couldn't make sense of God anymore.
Hmm.
I thought there was no, but so I've kind of got this background. And you talked about in the book, faith and fear, living from faith and fear. And every time I hear the word faith, it triggers me,
right?
Because I think of Christianity.
that part of the book stopped me again on my walk. And I was like, damn, like, can you just speak to that for the audience? I don't want to paraphrase it. I want you to talk about what living from faith versus living from fear means, because I think a lot of people listening to this do live from fear.
Yeah.
And I am adopting that philosophy going forward.
The good news is it has nothing to do with religion. So we take that off the table. And then the other thing worth knowing is that fear gives bad advice. And most people that are living in fear, which stands for, it's an acronym, stands for false evidence appearing real, that making decisions from that place will never materialize the thing that you want that's going to cause abundance in your life, period. I mean, it's just, you can't. And when I think of faith, when I go back to the rehab center that I eventually got released into that saved my life, I spent 11 months in this place rebuilding myself. They used to say all the time, you just have to have blind faith. And that was hard, man. I was like, I don't trust you. And you're asking me to have blind faith?
Yeah.
Like, you're a bunch of honest, and it was this really cool place. Now, looking back, it was cool. It was a bunch of ex-drug addicts that were the staff there, and they came from the adult program. So having somebody been through it before give you guidance turns out to be a winning strategy. At the time, I judged them because I'm like, you're just a bunch of drug addicts like me. And in hindsight, you know, I've come to realize that you're best equipped to help the people you once were. And here was these incredible humans that have dedicated their life to helping youth get through their addiction. And they were the ones trying to sell me on this blind faith. And for me, faith is just the belief in a positive, better future. And it has nothing to do with the religion side of it. It has to do with the spiritual side of it. It has to do with the belief that, you know, we're all connected. Like, there's an energy. You walk into a room, you feel people. So like, I don't need to give it a label. I'm just saying you, it's like somebody said, prove to me that God is real. And I said, prove to me you love your child.
Yeah.
Great. And they're like, well, that's dumb. I said, so is your comment. It's that dumb. Like, I don't have to prove anything. I believe. And the fun part that nobody's ever asked me, I just want you to know, when I wrote the book with my writing partner, Paul, before we wrote every session, we prayed. And he's a Christian, very good Christian. I'm not that good. He's the one that always prayed because he was good at it. I just love the energy it brought to the writing process. I love that every time we sat down to create, he asked God to use us to support other people. And I thought that was, and I'm glad that nobody's ever brought that up ever in an interview. Talk of 200 podcast interviews on that book. Nobody's ever brought that up. And it's because Paul wanted to make sure that that was felt, because he knew in my darkest days, when I turned to God and I asked him for help, sitting in a jail cell at 17, thinking he wasn't listening, was I wrong?
Mm. I have a friend who's Muslim, and I ask him, why do you pray five times a day? And he said, because five times a day, my ego needs to be reminded
that there's a
higher power above
me. Let's go.
And I was like, wow. And so that framework of like, we get to choose to live with a belief that the future is going to be positive or the future is going to be bad. That's basically faith and fear. And I really loved that in the book. And that whole energy, that mindset of service is so, so loud in the book. So fast forward, I saw you on the Ed Milet show and you were saying you've got a 9-figure net worth now. What were some of the big transactions that got you to there? Like, how did you actually do it? Like, you've built tech companies, education. Yeah. What are the vehicles that got you to where you are?
So I made my first 8 figures as a 20, like, and just so everybody listening understands, I got out of rehab at 17. Miraculously, I don't even know, like, again, I know now looking back, it makes perfect sense, but it never does looking forward or living life forward. But I got introduced to computer programming in rehab. And that introduction to programming and software became my new addiction. It literally became something that I allowed myself to be obsessed around. So anybody listening that wants to figure out what their thing is just whatever you love doing. And I know it's hard to, well, I love watching football. It's like, then go start a football gambling site. I don't know. Like, try to find the thing that you would do for free, because I'm telling you, if you're willing to do that, there's ways to create value in the world through that passion. And that's all I did. I fell in love with building tools. I love solving my own problems. I love building software. I loved automation. And, you know, I started when I was 17, failed twice meaningfully, like started a company, didn't work out, did another one, didn't work out. And then I went sideways for like 2 or 3 years from the ages of like 21 to 23, because I never thought of reading a business book, which sounds bananas, because I would read 25, 30 plus computer books. And then I finally hired a business mentor, guy named Bob. And Bob showed me the business side, which is completely different than writing code. So there's like the thing you do in business, and then there's actually the part of the business. And that company ended up making my first 8 figures. I sold that 4 years later. And then halfway through that, I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad. Yeah. And I wanted to be an investor.
This is before Clarity.
Yeah, yeah. This is like, I'm 24 when I started that company. I started angel investing because I had some extra money in my bank account at the end of the month. I was like, hey, I got a couple hundred thousand. You know, I'm 26. I didn't even think I was doing well. I remember the first time my accountant called me. His name was Mark. He calls me up and he goes, you want to hear something cool? I said, what's that? He goes, you have $1 million in cash in your business. My response was, is that good? He's like, yes, Dan, that's very good. I'm like, all right, cool. I got to get back to work. Like,
yeah,
you know, and it was kind of this process of just lonely building, grinding 100-hour weeks. So I sold that company when I was 28. And that afforded me essentially the ability to retire if I wanted to. Not living an extravagant life, but definitely, you know, put that money in some low risk thing and I'm good to go. But I just had it on my heart to keep building. So then I moved to Silicon Valley, so San Francisco, in 2008. And then I did 2 more venture-backed companies. So I did a company called Flowtown, exited that in 2012. Then I did another company, Clarity, which you're a customer of, sold that in 2014.
You had Cuban as an investor there, I see.
Yeah, Mark Cuban was an early investor. And it was funny because the day that exited, it occurred to me, looking back, that in a 10-year period, I built and exited 3 companies. And again, I thought I wasn't that good. Like, I literally was, as a Canadian, I was just, you know, Australians deal with this kind of crab in a bucket, not as good as. Trust me, I talked to them. I'm like, you are so good, but I can see you second guess yourself or you have self-doubt. I had that. And that's what kind of held me back from a while of really getting the bigger wins. And that made me, you know, quite wealthy. But it wasn't till I started, you know, doubling down on my investments, doubling down on my education, really understanding how to create value in the world at scale. And I would say the 2 phases was I started SaaS Academy, which was today is the world's largest coaching organization for software CEOs. We've got 3,000 clients. It's an incredible company that I own. I no longer CEO it, or I'm not involved in any of the coaching anymore. That's an amazing business, but that brought me deal flow. And then that's when I started buying software companies. So I have $100 million holdco with my business partner, Kevin. So we buy a software company every month right now. That's doing incredibly well. And then I have a venture company called Martell Ventures, where we incubate software companies that are AI first. That's our whole unique value proposition. Essentially, I co-create businesses with CEOs and bring them to market. And that's what I'm great at. I'm great at software. It's what I've done my whole life. Somebody this morning called me the Tony Robbins of tech. Okay. I spend 70% of my time on software things. I just happen to create a lot of content.
It's interesting because when I hear you say that, and I have just come off the back of this book, I'm like, you understand software deeply as a founder, but you're also an extraordinary coach because you've got such powerful, clear frameworks to take people through. So when there's a problem, you're like, hey, I've got this system over here that seems to be so reliable. And so, like, I loved in the book when you were talking about the difference between managing people on a sort of like, hey, I've got a problem, I'll fix it, as opposed, I can't remember the turn of phrase you used, but versus developing people.
Yeah.
So you're great at building.
Leadership.
Yeah. Transformational leadership. So you've got these skill sets that you've kind of developed outside of software, which makes you a great coach, but a great businessman as well. What I was going to ask you is, all of us have plateaus in business, right? And so you go from
one kind of mindset to another kind of mindset. So you went from founder to investor to now kind of
empire builder
now, right? And I heard you saying I'm gonna live to over 100, and that, when you think about that, it's like I look at Dan, who I am today, what I can do in the next 40 years is literally terrifying. You'd have no idea.
Dude, it's so cool. That's where people under index every day.
Totally, yeah.
Like 20 years ago, I was a broke backpacker in Australia. Today, I fly around on my own jet and have a supercar fleet and hang around with people that others would just like drool to spend time with. And that was in 20 years from zero. When I look at like starting at where I'm at now in the next 40 years, and that's why I love that you notice I'm on what vacation, but I don't get out of momentum.
Yeah.
I know these are my non-negotiables, and if I follow this process, I have 5 daily ones. I have my rhythm of existence for the weekly side. And when I'm in momentum, I get to create. I don't want to get out of that. And guess what? My family's totally okay with it because, you know, within that, we're still going to Dream World, or we're going to the beach, or we're doing whatever. I just know that I'm here to create. I'm a creator. I like to co-create with people that are cool. And I want to do that till I take my last breath. When people say like, oh yeah, why don't you retire? I'm like, retire from what? From being me? Like, if I was retired, I'd be sitting poolside and in 7 minutes deciding to start a new umbrella company and probably hiring the pool kid to be my first employee. Like, dude, that's just what I do. And it turns out, I think that's what entrepreneurs do. They just don't give themselves permission to do it in a way that actually is freeing. Yeah. Like, Adam, think about, like, I have a lot of rich friends that have money, okay? And it's either in a bank account or tied up in companies or in toys and stuff. And yet they still do things in their personal life that makes no sense to me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, instead of managing travel or managing all these assets, these vehicles, these houses you have, why don't you hire somebody to do that? Take that time that you were tinkering on all this. Because they say they're retired, but they spend more time on this toys. And then go create value. Like, you're most valuable to the market as late as life as you can because you have the most wisdom. Why would you take yourself out of the market to create more, to then do more with that? Like, unless you're literally transporting yourself around the world and you have some special machine and you can just like magically make money out of thin air, I think you should keep building.
Yeah, I mean, some of that stuff that's what the book's so great for, guys. For those of you, so many business people I meet and know, and, you know, I know my friend Lee's here in the studio today, and he's like any other entrepreneur, struggling all the time with, we're stuck. Tony Robbins says, you know, when we feel like we're on the edge of a breakdown, we're actually on the edge of a breakthrough. And I think that book is a big breakthrough for a lot of people. If these simple unlocks that you talk about, like getting a PA, getting a house manager. I got a house manager a couple of years ago, and the minute I did it, I was like, What was I doing before? Like being able to text her and say, hey, Mel, can you pick up the mail? Or can you do this? Can you do that? All these things come off your plate and it just creates so much more time to create.
And presence, man. Like the thing I'm most proud of is that when I'm with somebody, I'm with somebody.
Yeah.
Because I'm not thinking about where I need to be because I don't have to think about it. I always travel with somebody. Sam's here. He managed my calendar I'm back in the stateside and was just with my executive assistant down in Manly. Like I always have the team there because I want them to produce ahead of me. So my wife and I can be with our kids, can be with our friends. Like I don't want to think about how do I get from point A to point B. I want transportation thinking of. Like, it sounds crazy, but why have money if you don't use it for that?
And how much sooner could have you done it? Because so many times you meet people who are well past the point of being able to afford somebody to do it. Was it the same with you? Like, you look at it, look back, and it's about giving ourselves permission and leveling up to do those things, like getting your own plane, right? And
yeah, plane, chef, you know, it's so funny because could I have done it sooner? Yes. Emotionally, no. Because there's work you have to do. Like I'm working on some new frameworks because the book comes out and I have the privilege of talking to readers like yourself and just seeing kind of like what's the next level. And I've come up with this idea of like the trauma trigger barrier, because even the idea of letting go, you might be able to mechanically let something go, have your inbox managed by your assistant, have your purchases in your home managed by your house manager, but there could be some emotional shrapnel created in that is just really hard. You know, it's like an introvert that has a hard time being an extrovert.
Yeah.
Like whether they can do it mechanically, get on stage and speak, versus can they enjoy it? That's the part. When you say like, Dan, I see you coach people and you're great at that. That ability to like release the emotion is what I think I'm the best in the world at, because I had to do it for myself. Because you can hire people to do things, but if in that letting go, it just creates this internal anxiety because you're worried somebody's going to embarrass you or somebody's going to cost you a bunch of money, somebody's going to cost you your business, then letting go doesn't feel great. You literally start to create a prisoner of your existence. And that's the part that I underestimated the amount of work I had to do to get there, because it wasn't a financial decision. It was an emotional decision.
Interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
It is interesting.
Oh, so many people are like, they like give up their inbox and then they sit around all day worried that there's a bomb that's about to go off.
Yeah, yeah.
Because somebody forgot something or didn't pay something. I had a very wealthy woman I was coaching that she had a team. They did like multiple 8 figures a year. And she continued to keep the home stuff. Yet she had a whole, she knew. She's like, I don't get it, Dan. Like, I have somebody I don't pay the bills at my work. I don't, like, we have processes and budgeting and approval systems. But I still like to take care of the bills in my home. And I was, you know, but she was just maxed at home, right? She had a young family. She wanted to be present, but she was just running around, running errands. And I said, let's talk about the why. And when we got down to the core of it, her belief was, if I miss a payment to my children's private school, the school will think I'm a bad mom.
Wow.
Oof.
Wow.
So then once I understood why she couldn't let go, we worked on that.
Interesting.
Yeah, but there's these underlying beliefs that people have that hold them back that's not financial.
The story that you told, like when you got the opportunity to go skiing with Richard Branson, right? Like that, I've thought about that dilemma so many times in my entrepreneurial life where I'm like, how am I so goddamn busy and have so much stress and overwhelm, and I'm running a tiny company? These guys are running $5 billion businesses. When I met Richard, the one time I got to meet him, I asked him, what's the secret to like $5 billion business? Not a $5 billion one, five separate ones. And then you just, when you said you went skiing and you're there in the mountains, and the least stressed guy.
Dude, most relaxed.
Right.
The most, and the funniest, and the most present.
And people think, well, you got billions of dollars in the bank, it's stress-free, but it's not actually true at all. In Korea, money, like Biggie said it best, right? More money, more problems, right? That's still a choice and a skill set to learn to manage your life that way.
Yeah.
And so for all the entrepreneurs out there listening, I urge you to buy the book and just really tune into this idea that you can actually be more successful and make way more money and be far less stressed as well. And the minute you're open to that idea, I think it really is a big unlock for people. It's just being that there are people out there, you've got to keep finding those coaches like yourself that have done it and just being, you know, persistent in solving it.
Yeah.
It's absolutely incredible. I'm going to throw a quote at you that I'd love you to comment on. So I saw this, I can't remember where I saw it, but you said, if someone bought your business tomorrow, what's the first thing they'd change and why aren't you making that decision today?
It's, you know, I believe that questions are the programming language of the mind because they help you redesign your points of view, right? So I'm a student of great questions. And oftentimes when I'm coaching somebody in business, and I clearly see the thing. For example, I was coaching an individual, and I remember the first call we had, you know, he shares with me, this is where we're at, and this is the revenue as a software CEO. And we were looking over the structure of the company. He says, well, this part of the business we can't touch, though. And it was the marketing and the sales side. I said, why is that? He says, my wife runs that. Oh, okay. Wow. Why can't we change anything? He goes, well, we have an agreement that she doesn't tell me what to do. I don't tell her what to do. I was like, we're going to have an issue, man. Like, it's not like I can fix half of the business, especially marketing and sales. And that's an example of asking somebody that simple question. If somebody tomorrow bought your business, what's the first thing they would change? Well, they would change that. They would change. And then why haven't you made that decision? Nobody else has to buy the business. For most people, the answer is something like raising prices, you know, growing the product line, you know, letting people go that they've been there forever, that are literally taking down your business, right? And the reason they don't do it is because there's either some sunk cost fallacies, there's, you know, there's fear around that decision. And that's why I think you always give better advice to somebody else, especially a stranger, because it's the right decision without any fear of the work. And so asking questions like that, or finding series of questions that really get you clear on sequencing, because I believe that success is a byproduct of sequencing. Sequencing equals success. Understanding the right order we do things. A question can reset the mind and get to the heart of it, because there's no lack of how to. I can Google how to do anything, raise capital, run Facebook ads, do social media marketing. What comes up for people is the beliefs around the activity.
What story, like I heard Hormozi say, most people's joy or unlock is on the other side of two or three difficult discussions.
Yep.
What stories or frameworks do you tell yourself when you have to have a difficult discussion, perhaps with somebody you love that you know is holding you back or the business back? How do you support? Like, I think, you know, you and I have been in business a long time, and it's probably automatic now that we know people don't die when you have a hard discussion and then 5 minutes later they've moved on, everything's all right. But there's a lot of people stuck there in some way, whether it's in a personal relationship, a business relationship. What narrative is going on?
There's a lot of different ones. Like for me to audit, it'd be tough to do it on the spot, but I'll give you a few that have come up because I've worked through this. And I'll start with an example. There was an individual in my life that I would call a friend, that another friend of mine called me to inform me that that person was talking shit about me at a dinner. And he felt so awkward about it, he didn't even want to call me because he didn't know what to do with that. But he's just like, this is somebody that you consider a really close friend. This is a long time ago. And I will tell you, confronting that person, which I knew I had to, okay? Because a long time ago, I learned that if somebody does you wrong and you don't say anything, then you essentially teach people how to treat you. And if I don't say anything, I've taught that person it's okay. And it's not okay, because if somebody's a friend, rule number one is you're not somebody who talks crap about me behind my back. I don't care how many drinks you've had. I don't care what the circumstances. So I remember I organized a dinner at their house with our families. This is like that close of a person where we did life with families together. Wow. And we went to pick up the food and I'm sitting in the car. My heart's racing, dude. I felt like I was in high school breaking up with a girl or something. I was like, this is so crazy. And I just blurted out. And the guy gets quiet. And then he apologizes for the dinner, but he's telling me about a different dinner.
Hey guys, I hope you are enjoying this podcast. I just wanted to let you know that we are going to be opening Unemployable Coaching 2025 in mid-January. This is going to be a really exciting program. It's going to include all the amazing things you saw in the last year: private property tours, private training days, one-on-one coaching, and so much more. If you are interested in being notified, simply go to unemployable.com.au/coaching. That's unemployable.com.au/coaching. Put in your information, we'll let you know. With that said, let's get back to the pod.
So that also told me it wasn't the first time. But, you know, he just shared with me his perspective and he probably shouldn't have done it. And he said he was sorry. And afterwards, it was actually a lot better than I thought it would go. My wife asked, she's like, how'd it go? I said, it went a lot better than I thought. Unfortunately, it happened again.
Wow.
And then I had to create some space. Now, the mental model that I use to make those conversations okay is, one, if I had to have this conversation 1,000 times, how would I feel the 1,001 time? See, most people just don't have a lot of reps. The first time I let somebody go, I stressed about it for 6 weeks. I cried.
Yeah.
And I was an emotional wreck for days later.
I still hate it. I think, like, it's the worst job.
Okay, but I've now had to do it so many times, and I've changed my frame around. I don't even call it firing, I call it a transition. I always try, if they're good to me, I always try to find them a better place to go. My beliefs are they'll be a star at another company. They could never be for me because of what I need and what they are. And that's totally fine. They might not see it that way, I see it that way. So it's really just asking yourself, it's called the expert frame. If I had to run through this scenario 1,000 times, how would I feel at the end of that is how I can bring into my life today. Because at the end of the day, our feelings are a byproduct of the stories that we make around the meaning. Mm. So it's not that I'm letting the person go, because I could tell myself a meaning that I hate them and I want to see them fail. Or I can say, I'm doing this because I love my team and I love them. And I know that that person is never going to thrive in our environment, and holding them back would be selfish of me, because I'm only doing it because letting them go would be painful for me. Mm. So selfishly, I'm keeping them in a place they'll never be able to grow because it's good for me. So you just learn over the years to kind of rewrite the stories.
It's a great framework.
Yeah, that just because you just say, well, what if I, it's like, you know, another thing that would be hard would be like, you know, breaking up a business partnership. Maybe you've been business partners with somebody for 10 years and you know that person's on a different growth path than you are and your visions are not aligned anymore. And it's, you know, similar to the conversation I had with one of my friends. And I would just say, pretend like you've had that conversation 10,000 times or 1,000 times. Because, and I've done it so many times in business because I'm involved in so many companies. I think the team just asked me to have those conversations because I don't have a problem. And I do it right away. I don't sit on it, because that's the other thing. It's like, as soon as I know I need to make the decision, make it.
Yeah, it's really important. There are times in business where it's just difficult. And those conversations are part of it. Changing gears for a minute, you've had phenomenal success over the last few years since you've leaned into socials. You know, maybe you could share the metrics. I think you've gotten 3 million followers or something now after
the last 16 months.
16 months from zero, or not zero, but to significant growth. I'm really interested in why you just, a lot of business people, I was kind of late to this myself, and I watched them one after another. I watched PBD, and then I watched Alex, and I watched these guys just one by one. I was so late on it, right? And producing content at scale. Why did you do that? And who are you, like, well, let's start there. And then I want to talk about whose content you're consuming and who inspires you.
Yeah. Right now. So what happened was, is my book came out January 17th, 2023, last year. And it did wait. I remember talking to my publisher and I was like, what would make you happy? Because they gave me money to write a book. They said 4,000 copies would be great. I said, cool, I should be able to pull that off. And in the first 2 weeks, we sold 20,000 copies. Mm-hmm. And for me, as a, you know, spiritual person, I realized that I've been asking God to have impact. And he gave me the tool, this blue book. And here I was about ready to get back to building businesses and buying companies and essentially doing a bunch of stuff that makes the people I do business with money, but doesn't help a lot of other people. And, you know, at the time I was doing media tour for the book and I was visiting folks and doing podcasts, and I was super inspired by some of these people online that you mentioned, just watching how they operate and then talking to them about the way it supports their dreams and their goals. And what I underestimated was the impact of two things, reach and reputation. If you have a vision for your life in the future and it's big, I've come to believe, and it's true, that everything you want sits on the backside of your reputation. Hopefully you have a positive one. And who knows of you, your reach. Because that will allow you to get access, to solve problems, to have opportunities that nobody else could ever achieve. You know, Naval Ravikant talks about these concepts of four level of luck. When you are the person in your industry that is the person, you get other people's luck, other people's hard work, because they want to collaborate with you. There are companies that are $100 billion companies that will only sell to one person when they decide to sell, and it's Warren Buffett, because of his reputation and his reach. And they do the annual conference, and he doesn't need to do social media because his content is so good, it gets distribution on social media, right? I always think about this when people are talking about content. I go, you know the guy named Jesus? They're like, yeah. I go, he didn't write a piece of content. Think about that. He was so good at what he did, people had to talk about him, to write about him. So it's also an interesting concept of just saying, are you good enough to do this? And if you're not, I think it's a, you know, when I make decisions of what businesses I start or what I should start doing, I always ask myself, what is the thing that scares me the most? And I will tell you, when I was being honest with myself, the book was doing well and I knew it could do really well if I was willing to do the media side of it. And I was talking to all these people and that gave me anxiety. And what did that mean for the future? And what about my privacy? And I was like, that's the thing I got to go do. And what shifted was this simple mental model, this framework of going from having a marketing department to building a media company. And very deliberately, very strategically, with a lot of intention, I built Martell Media, not a book marketing or a content thing on the back end. It was.
What does that look like? What is Martell Media? What does that mean in real terms? Like, how many people are working for you in Martell Media? What is the objective of Martell Media? Like, why do that?
It's a beautiful question. So like I talk about in my book, I'm a fan of, you know, building the team under the challenge. So step one, I hired a guy named Sam. So he became my creative director. Been working with Sam for 6 years now. And I didn't know what it was going to be at first. I just decided, I literally said, we're going to build this thing called Martell Media. And it's going to be a media company that produces media for Dan Martell. And I'm going to treat my name like a brand. Like, I know how to build companies. You know, Virgin is a brand. I have to go create content. And it started with Sam. And then it quickly, I hired Todd, who actually runs Martell Media. He's the general manager. And then they built the company. I think there's about 12 to 14 people that work on it. And it's just my content. But today, if you look at our statistics, we're one of the fastest growing brands in entrepreneurship. We last month alone, we did 140 million views on our content.
That's insane.
In 30 days.
Yeah, we're starting to see, we're not at that level, but we're the penny's slowly dropped. We've been a year here and we're starting to see that value of this evergreen content that's out there, views every single day.
And it's an annuity. This is why, like, so what's interesting is nobody told me this when I started, even though I know all the people you mentioned earlier and I talked to them, but our revenue from just ads that are run on our YouTube channel, we're about 8 months away from it covering our production costs.
For 12 people.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Isn't that crazy? Okay, so there's that. Then there's the, how many leads and opportunities of companies that want to sell me their business? Well, that went great. Books, the revenue on the back end of the book is bananas. Companies I'm investing in, quality through the roof. Invites to things that I would have never been invited to. Speaking on Tony Robbins' stage, I'm now part of the content for Business Mastery.
Yeah.
So I spoke there once. I didn't mess it up. They asked me to come a second time. I did a good job the second time. And I've spoken there three times so far and I'm there in a month. Like,
it's hard to quantify until you start down that path.
You have to have faith.
Yeah, because at the start, it's such a slow game, right? Like I look at Dorito stuff. I go back and I look at Patrick Bet-David stuff and I tell people, go back to his videos and reel.
First ones.
The first one, he's sitting there, he sucked, you know, like I've seen Russell Brunson's.
Dude, mine sucks so bad. The early ones we unpublished that I told Sam, let's turn them back on. Like they were so bad.
So you've got Martell Media. So when you say it's your content, you're documenting your life, your business, you're producing reels and clips and
just the whole thing. So my philosophy is I want to capture, I don't want to create. So what I've done working with Sam and the team is say, here's what I do in my life. I look at companies, I buy companies, I mentor CEOs I'm invested in. I do cool things. I wake surf, I snowboard, I mountain bike, I snow bike, I travel the world. I have my book. I do some speaking gigs a couple times a year. How does that become content that the market wants? Because there's one thing to say like, here's what I want to do versus that's cool, but nobody cares.
Yeah.
You know, like a vlog, most people are like, I'll do a vlog. Nobody gives a crap about your life. Okay. There's no value in it for them. If you package it right, it now becomes valuable. So I just think it's interesting because I just want to say this. There's a lot of people that have attention, but they have no influence. They have a big audience, but they have no ability to get anybody to do anything, right? There's like these train wrecks of people online that everybody follows or knows about. I would say like Fousey right now on streaming, like, I mean, he's old school YouTube that's kind of been a streamer now. And like, if he told you to buy a cold plunge, he might sell two,
yeah,
right? Whereas you have other people that are folks that might have 60,000 followers on TikTok, but if they said, this is a cold plunge I use, they'll sell 1,000 units.
Yeah.
That to me is interesting, the influence side. How do you do that? You got to create value. Value comes from only two ways. I either entertain you or I educate you, period. Mr. Beast would be a perfect example of entertain. Patrick Bet-David, who's my coach, I hired him this year to work with me, he'd be a great example of educate, right? And even entertain with some of the political stuff he does. But I just think that when you do that in a market, you create goodwill. And then when you have something that you want to put, shine a light on, then they'll listen. So that's why I remember a long time ago, my buddy came to me and he was doing a fundraiser for an employee that unfortunately got cancer. He's like, "Hey man, can you post this on your social media?" And I was like, "I can, but man, I told you 6 years ago to start building your audience."
Yeah.
Because when you need it and you don't have it, dude, you wish you did. If you write a book and you don't have an audience and you hope your book does well, too late.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a byproduct of goodwill. So I was willing, and that's what changed last year when I built Martell Media. I was willing to invest my dollars and my time, because I think that's when you want to tell me what your priorities are. I'm going to look at your bank account. I'm going to look at your calendar, into creating goodwill in the market for the future. There was no need to monetize it right away. It's in the future. I'm okay with that. I put the budget aside. Hey, Sam, you have unlimited budget. Go create. Now, what we decided is to go from amateur to pro. I was an amateur. I posted on YouTube for 9 years straight. Never missed a week, ever. My videos did not get better.
Yeah.
That's amateur hour. That's weekend warrior. That's what most people do in life. They hobble along, but they don't get better. And that was the big difference, is when I decided to invest time and my bank account, I decided to go pro. And I said, whatever that looks like, let's figure it out.
It starts with the investment, doesn't it? You know,
like, it has to be.
You know, like when we came in here, this was an empty shell, and you know, we fit it out with no idea like how it would go. It's going great. But when you make that commitment, it makes such a difference. That story you told in the book of the kid that came up to you at the gym and said, "Hey, Dan, I want to make content." And you're like, "Dude, you've bounced up to the wrong dude, because I'm going to give it to you.
I'm going
to
give you the answer."
Maybe you're going to love that story quickly, because so many people want the result, but they're just sort of edging, they're hedging, they're not committing fully to a path. We can skip that story. I want to ask you another story quickly. I mean, I heard you say that you want to be a billionaire, and you know, you've gotten to the 9, you want to get to the 10 figures. How important do you think Martell Media is in that journey toward being a billionaire?
It's everything.
It's everything.
It's everything. Here's what I think. I think that you can have a business, you can have systems and processes, and make multiple millions of dollars. Billion requires brand. You talked about Richard Branson, Virgin. I remember when I spent that week with him, and I had dinner every night. And one night I asked him, I said, "There's a lot of stuff you can do right in business. What's the thing that most people underinvest in?" And he said, "Brand." And I literally thought to myself, he's old. He doesn't know. I can't believe I'm honest with you. When he said that, I said, "That's not the new world we live in." Was I wrong? He got it. Because I was building software companies and exiting, and I'm like, revenue is the thing. So like, if I have revenue, people will buy me, who cares? Brand is just this beautiful thing. Like, when you understand the difference between a Kellogg's and a Nike, you know, and even Apple as a brand, right? Trust, competing against Samsung. Like, there's something intangible about having your name mean something. Right? Having somebody talk about you in a positive light at a dinner, and then they go, "Oh, man, that guy sounds like he could solve my problem. Hey, Bob, can you send the jet to go pick up Dan and bring him to our office on Monday? I'd love to sit down with him for 30 minutes." And all of a sudden you're in a meeting that you can't understand. How did you even get into that meeting? That's the level of operation that people underestimate. I think a billion requires a brand, a positive brand of people that want to do business with you, because you will be able to attract top talent. You'll get people to trust you quickly. They'll be thinking of ways to interact with you into their life. So all of a sudden their growth, you get to essentially hook into that. It's just part of it. And I looked at like the leading domino. If my number one skill in life is solving problems, and I also know I could not study enough every book to get a PhD in every problem in my life to know the answer to the question, then the next best thing is to know the person in the world who's the best at the thing and have them want to take my phone call.
Yeah.
Want to take my phone call. And that's what I think I used to believe, you know, it's who you know. And now I'm like, no, it's who knows you. Before I show up, if people like Patrick Bet David, before I even worked with them, like, he doesn't coach people.
He's a weapon, absolute weapon.
And so like, I just wired him some money. And I said, it's either a donation to a charity of your choice, or you take a couple calls with me. And he's like, dude, I love your stuff. Let's talk. And I just think like, that's, that leading domino makes everything else easier. I remember when I made the decision, I was worried because I had to renegotiate 80% of my calendar. And I sat down, I called every one of my business partners and I thought they were going to push back. And you know, those tough conversations, I wasn't looking forward to it. I had to go for a walk in the woods, 3 hours where I knew to have reception, just pace back and forth. And every one of them said, what took you so long?
You see all these private equity and VC guys looking for deal flow, and they
deal flow. If they saw my deal flow, they would just run by themselves.
Guys like you and Alex and PPD, I mean, I know what we have inbound, and I look at you and I'm like, oh my God, like you have to have a team just to
match. I have a team. This is what people don't get. They like pitch me ideas all the time. I go, cool, send it to this email. Cooper on my team will look at it. Matt will look at it. Like, I don't look at it. I can't. There's so much noise in the system now, which is a beautiful byproduct of brand. And guess what? 140 million last month. In a year, we're going to be doing $1 billion a month. Mm-hmm. When you're at 1 billion views a month, like, that's why Mr. Beast, I don't know how much Amazon just paid him for the Beast thing they just announced, but it's a lot, right? And it's post meaning of money.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's not about if you're trying to just get rich, yeah, read the book, do the system, you're good to go. Yeah. If you want to build something, you want to build a life that you can't pay to get access to. Nobody, you couldn't pay Tony Robbins to put you on a stage.
No.
He wouldn't do it. There's a million people who would love to be on that stage.
It's post-economics, yeah.
It's post-economics. It is a decision somebody makes based on who they see. And it's usually by ways that you created value in their life before you ever meet them. Like my buddy Justin, who I looked up to, he's a brilliant man, great entrepreneur, texted me this morning and said, hey dude, I heard your voice in my living room. It was my 20-year-old son listening to your YouTube videos.
Yeah.
Thank you for mentoring him. I could never give Justin enough money that he would care. But the fact that he appreciates that I'm putting out content that's going to help his 20-year-old son, that personally, that means more than anything that I could ever do for somebody I care about. And the fact that that adds value in his life, that's super cool.
And I think a big part, like, you know, I watch guys like you, I watch guys like PBD and Grant and a lot of these guys, and the guys that really rise to the top just have this remarkable vision. And watching Pat now with his new premises there, I watched on election night, like the rest of the world did, what was happening in the US. And I was on YouTube and I switched between CBS and Fox and Valuetainment, and he beat everybody. And I'm like, this dude is a YouTuber. He had more viewers. He had 225,000 people watching live, which is more than any other major network. And when I started seeing this happen, that's when I really realized the power of this content, and not only the eyeballs, but the trust and everything that goes along with it. It's just exceptional. In the book, it's interesting. You talked in detail about your vision boards, and you know, it's so easy when you've been in the personal growth or the business game for a long time. I remember going to my first Bob Proctor seminars or Jim Rohn. They say, you're going to get a vision board or even your Tony Robbins stuff. But you still do that. And you were saying that you have a newspaper, front page of a newspaper that is talking about your company and you. And
totally. Yeah, I have one framed in our studio at Martel Media.
What does it say? Well, what's the you know, like the vision? You know, where
I mean, I actually think a billion is inevitable. Yeah. It's more like multi-billion. I'm more interested in the amount of millionaires I create.
Yeah, just
or support. Like, I just see a future, and I'm a techno optimist. Like, I think AI is going to create a future where you won't have to work. Like, if you just like look at the simple technologies out there, like, you know, Tesla's robots, the humanoids, and you look at the sophistication of obviously ChatGPT and all that stuff. Like, we're going to get to a world where anything we need for sustenance, food and transportation, all that is the marginal cost of it is going to be pennies. So knowing that, then the question is, okay, well, what doesn't get disrupted? And I share this because I call it neural transformation. Until the day, and it will come, that Elon can implant the Neuralink into your brain and I can airdrop you my belief set, because then that'll circumvent your points of view, that'll get you a different behavior, which will get you different results. Until that happens, the most powerful thing that I can do is help other people shift their beliefs around their current reality. And my vision is to continue to support entrepreneurs that do that, write books that help people do that. Because it's the most defensible future-proof thing I could possibly do. Because there's two challenges when you have a human or a brain involved is the input-output, which is the speed that you can consume, which is your brain reading information, and then typing. Your output is where we're most constrained. Our ability to input information, talk is faster than typing, but it's still quite low latency. Like, it's not fiber optic level speed. And then the other one is processing information, actually taking action on it, that we know in our heart, like we said earlier, what's one thing you would change if somebody bought your business, that we just don't do. And I spend my time there. I spend my time trying to figure out technologies, companies, investments to make. But yeah, that's my vision. I'm actually already doing what I want to do in the future. It's just going to have a whole lot more zeros at the end. So like, the media stuff will always be a huge part of my life. My venture stuff will always be a part of my life. And then my charitable stuff, which is working with at-risk youth, will always be part of my life. I don't want to create anything new. If it's new, it's within those structures and somebody else is spearheading it. And I'm doing no different than having dinner with them. Because that is light and that is fun for me. I just think the way it looks in the implementation, we're already starting to do that. We're like, I've got to go travel to give a keynote on stage on my jet. And I ask one of my business partners to fly with me. And like, then all of a sudden business is life. Or I have like meetings, you know, I'm on vacation in Australia and I have a day where I want to meet with companies I'm looking to invest in, and the team schedules 14 of those. And I just sit down and we have a good time. We joke around. I learn what they're doing. I try to add some value, and then I decide to make an investment. Like, the vision I have is more of how it gets executed, less about what it is, because the three buckets of my life will never change. I mean, those are the impact side with King's Club and other youth stuff I do. My venture stuff is where the wealth creation will come from. And then the media stuff just enables both of those.
Yeah.
Now, I want to tell everybody listening, because I just went to like multi-billion level and they're still like, I'd like to make my first 500,000. Is that wealth creation requires concentration. And the biggest fallacy people talk about is, well, you know, diversification. Wealth preservation is diversification, but wealth creation, I focus. I go all in. And I think that's where a lot of people get it wrong. I've been a software guy from day one. I'll be a software guy when I take my last breath. Everything else is supportive of that. It's what I do better than anybody else in the world. It's because I have 27 years of experience doing it. And that's what you meet with a Richard Branson or a real estate mogul or a media person, is that they, Mr. Beast, they know how to do one thing really well. And all the other stuff is almost additive to that core. It's not a completely different core.
Yeah. They only start and diversify in business once they've had.
Later, once there's more cash coming in than they know how to redeploy in the business. Because honestly, investing in your business and this is Warren Buffett's favorite metric, is return on equity, ROE. Then you take that cash and you start doing other stuff. It could be real estate, or, you know, passive is kind of a funny term. It's levels of active, but yeah. And for me, it's always been software.
Yeah. Nothing will return like a business. You know, real estate, Bitcoin, you can name whatever you want. Nothing will return like a business.
Yeah.
We're almost out of time, Dan. I want to ask you, what is the one question or line of questioning that you wish when you came on a podcast, people were more interested in about you and your views of the world? Where the gold is that people just leave out or miss?
I think it's this cool question that Peter Thiel talked about earlier on. I think 2009, I heard him talk, and he uses it for interview questions, which is, what's something you believe about the world that most people don't?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a beautiful question, because, you know, in asking that, you'll figure out what makes somebody extra. So if you think about it, if everything you believe, everybody else believes, then your life will be mediocre, right? Through the definition of the fact that you'll do the same thing everybody else does. And I think even when we talk about content, if everything you're saying on social media, everybody agrees with, you're not saying anything.
Yeah.
So like, I think one thing that I believe that most people don't believe is that it's around accountability. I am 1,000% accountable for my life. Like, I'm talking 1,000%. I'm not talking a little bit. I'm not talking about like on good days. I'm talking about everything, from every interaction to every moment, every what happens outside of my control, inside of my control. I'm accountable for it, period, because I get to decide the meaning I associate to what happens. My existence is 100% under my control. My reality is a byproduct of my frequency. Like, my energy states how I see the world. Mm-hmm. And I think that's when we talk about like positive expectation versus negative expectation, it really comes down to that. I think most people aren't accountable to their thoughts, and they don't really truly say, man, I do have a negative response to this scenario, right? I do default to it not working out. So weird. Like, they don't even see themselves do it. I spend time with people, unless they're paying me to coach them, I don't say shit. I just watch it and let them live in that little reality. But I'm just a big fan of saying, you know, when you asked me earlier, like, what do you do to get to the next level? You kind of went there and we didn't really talk about it. The one question I go back to is, who do I need to become? Period, full stop. Who does Dan need to become to unlock that next level? It's not do either. It's not, what do I need to do? That's the wrong question.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, who do I need to become? Because beingness is what attracts those things. That vision board could be in my life tomorrow if I understood how to be the kind of person that other people wanted to see win at that level, that they would want to give me those things. Now, somebody might listen and go, well, that's dumb. Nobody's going to give me a jet. Not true. There are people that have been gifted a jet, just like you give $10 to a person on the side of the street. There are people in business that give, hey, I don't want this business anymore. Can you take it over? $5 million business. Happens every day. Mm-hmm. Doesn't happen to you because you're not in that energy. Nobody would want to see you win at that level. I just think that's the question. And that's why media for me is such a beautiful personal development program. You want to work through your bugaboos and find out where your trauma triggers are? Hey, go talk to your phone and post it on your Facebook. And then sit back and read your comments. And let me tell you that the internet will tell you where your insecurities lie that you didn't even know you had.
Try doing it with teeth like this, man.
Dude, they're great teeth, though. They're great teeth.
Man, it's so true, though. When you do put yourself out there, you are going to bump into all of that stuff. But I really think that what you said there is so powerful that it's very easy to miss it, that 1,000% accountability of your life. And there will be people listening going, well, sure, Dan, you got a private jet. You travel the world, you got, you know, all this money. Of course, you're totally accountable for your life now. But what they don't understand is that at some point, you had those same belief systems before it was all there, right? That's what gets you there.
That you know, until you experience it, you hear it, and it doesn't make sense. It's like having an executive assistant, right? I know a lot of people don't want an EA because they don't want to be accountable to somebody else.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want somebody in my inbox. I don't want somebody in my calendar. Like, I want, they think that success is freedom. It's not. Success is fulfillment. It comes on the back end of doing hard things and feeling useful. Because, like, I'll tell you what prison or hell looks like, sitting on a beach drinking Mai Tais for 6 months in a row by yourself. Mm. You want to go into a negative, downward, psychological depression? Go do that. Mm. That's not fun. Fun is variety, fun is challenges. And like, just to add some value to everybody listening, like, most people don't even have an executive assistant. That's level one of the book, right? Because they don't know what they would do. What do I get them to do? Okay, Dan, I want to buy back my time, but what do I do? If anybody listening, Adam, wants my internal playbook, I'll give it to them. Just follow me on Instagram because we're trying to grow our account, and message me the word EA Adam. If they're listening to this pod, I'll give it to them. It's a direct link to a Google Doc, and it's got everything. It's got my North Star principles. It's got my agendas for my meetings. It's got templates for how I say no. That's a hard one for people. And it's got all the procedures of all the things, preference files that they do for me so that I can learn to let go, so I have the space to become more.
Yeah.
I would not be able to do the work to be who I am today, to continue to do the work, if I didn't have people that supported my dreams at the level I do, because I would be busy. And that's the truth, Adam. It's just people are busy.
Yeah, and it's going to push up against a lot of people's limiting beliefs of, you know, Australia has this crab in a bucket mentality.
Yeah.
And you're going to feel like what we call a wanker down here saying, I need an executive assistant. But you actually, it's part of your growth to say, hey, I need to step up. I need to free up my time. I do need an assistant to handle my house, my bills, and these different things. It's just part of your growth, guys. If you're listening to this, is finding the awkward and leaning into it sometimes.
It's literally admitting your time is valuable And if you don't take your time seriously, nobody else will.
Yeah, therein lies the problem, right? Guys, that's it for today. Dan, amazing to have you on the pod.
It's an honor.
Thank great God. To have you here and to see you 10 years later.
Yeah, super cool.
A lot of time has passed. As I said at the start, guys, this is not meant to be a pitch for the book. It's just that book is amazing. And I don't say that lightly because a lot of them are not. It's really good stuff. Follow Dan on socials. He will add value to your life daily. So make sure you get over there and follow. Dan, thanks for being here. Thanks for being back in Australia. And whenever you're back, we'd love to have you back as well.
Thanks so much.
Appreciate it so much. Cheers.
Hey there. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Unemployable. If you'd like to watch another episode, just click there.